Happy Tuesday, everyone. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts for one more day. I hope you're having a good day. The sun was up early this morning. We're going to get some rain later, but not a bad Tuesday at all so far. Anyway, we've got a lots on the agenda. Yesterday, we had a lot of response, a big response, one of the biggest I've seen. And since then, I've noticed a lot of social media discussion about trying to get AstraZeneca shots at pharmacies. So what I'm going to do is ask people to text us, 580-580. Keep sending us your stories of attempting to get shots at pharmacies. If it is good, I want to hear it. If it was seamless, I want to hear it. And if you're still on that waiting list, these phantom waiting lists that don't seem to be activated at all, I want to hear it as well. Because there is a significant amount of frustration out there because for a certain segment of the population, this is the only option right now. Yes, the province, just this morning, we're going to talk about it, has dropped the age eligibility in certain postal codes. That's a good thing, down to 45. But the pharmacies, for a lot of people, are still the only option. A lot on the table. We're going to start with our big five stories. That's a big stinger. Wow. Leslie's got it all set up here. Joining us on the phone is Michael Wood, an advocate for small business. Great to have you with us, Michael.
Thank you so much, Graham. Great to speak with you again.
Yeah, and Chris Holsky is here as well. Hey, Chris.
Morning.
I want to start with this story in the Globe. The Premier hinted last week that a big thing's coming. We're going to have the best in the country. And then no details on paid sick leave. And now the Globe is reporting today that the offer from Ontario is we're going to make the $500 for sick pay for essential workers who don't have sick pay in their benefits. If they get sick, they lose money. That's $500 under the federal program. We're going to top that up by doubling it to $1,000, but the federal government has to administer it. What do you make of this just on the surface, Michael Wood?
Well, I think that it's such a tough situation. You know, there's been a lot of opportunity for both levels of government to work together to get this done. You know, the federal government's seen a very slow uptick in their sick benefits program that they've been running. The province now wanting to give another $500 a week to boost it. I think we all just have to get on the same page and we have to help those people. Sending people or people going to work sick is not going to get us out of this pandemic anytime sooner. And whatever this is going to take, I think we have to, whether it's a part of the issue or whatever, just everybody sit down, close the door, and figure this out.
Chris, do you think it's going to work?
Well, I don't think this is exactly what employees want.
Is it set up to fail? Do you think the feds will say no and then it's the blame game again?
Well, whether they say yes or no, this when it gets down to the workers themselves, this is, I think, still not what they're looking for. They're looking for an assurance that if they take a day off because they're sick, that money is still going to be on whatever paycheck that they collect. And this is still not that system. It's still the federal, hey, let's apply for this and then get a check in the mail sometime down the road to see whether you get that kind of compensation for taking a day off. And the problem right now with the federal program that people have taken issue with is that it doesn't really exist in that matter. And even though more money, still that's a good thing, even though more money would be coming the unemployees' way, it's not exactly what they're asking for.
The other thing that strikes me about this, I'm on salary. If I get sick, I still get paid. And so I'm coming at this from a completely different perspective than an hourly worker. And I totally understand that. But even for me, a few months ago, I had a little tickle in the throat and I'm like, is this it? Do I go get a test? Because as soon as I go get the test, it kind of ripples through my work. It ripples through my life. It was less than a tickle and I didn't do it. I didn't go get a COVID test and it went away within like 2 hours. You know, and so I can't imagine having to look at my bills and make that call. For me, Michael, I'm looking at it like a convenience thing, a workload for colleagues thing. Like they're going to have to rearrange the schedule and hold off for a couple of days until I get my test results. As it turned out, I didn't have to face that. But I can't imagine doing all of that and thinking about the fact that I may not be able to pay my bills. I am not surprised at all that people are going to work, hourly workers are going to work sick.
Yeah, absolutely, Graham. And, you know, if we look at it, you know, and I don't want to diminish what we're talking about, but if we look at, you know, small business owners, you know, myself, I haven't been able to draw a paycheck from my business, and I've been on the CRB. I have no problem telling anybody that. And you're right. Like, for me right now, I make $1,800 a month from the government. And I look at my bills, and, you know, I've been able to work some things out. But you're right. And people also, I think, forget that exactly what you're saying. They feel responsible to their coworkers. Nobody wants to leave them swamped with so much going on. You know, we're part of a society that wants to help each other. And right now, we need the government to help those so that they don't have to go in, that they can do the right thing, and we can get out of this pandemic as soon as possible.
Michael, is there a system that you, as a business operator, would prefer here, from an operator's perspective here?
Sure. And I spoke to one of the NDP critics the other day, because the other side of it from a business perspective is, who's going to pay for the sick days? It has to be a government thing. It cannot fall on the shoulders of small business owners right now. You know, there's a lot of businesses that have done okay during the pandemic, but there's more that haven't. So, you know, I would like to see the province and the federal government come up with whatever plan it's going to be, but easy to access. If we look at the vaccine sign-up portal, which has been difficult on its own, you know, we need just one simple access point where people can apply. Now, the only last thing I'll just add to this is that when I apply for the CRB, you know, I think it's like 3-5 days it takes, they say, will be in my account. People are paid every 2 weeks. So I think that if we have the process in place, that we can do this and people won't miss that 1 or 2 days worth of pay, right? So
I don't think people are taking it because I don't think it's enough. $500 a week, that's not enough for a worker in a warehouse that's trying to support a family. And I think it's not fast enough. And I think they're sitting there going, "I'm going to take sick days. I'm going to not work. I'm going to go get a test. And I'm going to isolate at home because the government's going to pay my bills, and I'm going to get this $500. It's not enough of an incentive. That's just the and people are like, "Oh, I'm surprised that people haven't taken it up." It's $500 a week. That's $100 a day. That doesn't cover bills for a family. For an hourly worker in a warehouse, for instance, in Brampton, who is not making minimum wage. So you've got to match the wages, at least come closer to matching the wages.
Well, then maybe $1,000 works, because then you're talking about up to $4,000 for the course of a month, and that's a lot. That's comparable to that's better than CERB,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
And but again, it's a question of timeliness in the application process. And Mike talking about, you know, every 2 weeks somebody gets a paycheck. If it's a system that is in line with that kind of speed, then maybe this could work.
Let's move on. Vaccine shopping, one of our other big five stories. Vaccine shopping, and I've got a bit of a beef with this because, you know, we got to clarify what we're talking about here. So yesterday we had in the news, like, people who are not showing up and people who are canceling booked appointments. That is vaccine shopping. If you're on multiple wait lists, that's not vaccine shopping from my perspective. They have told us, get the first shot you can. They've got a triple sort of complicated way to sign up here with pharmacies, with public health locally, and with the province. There's three different paths. So if they're calling being on multiple wait lists while having another booking and then refusing those shots, I don't call that vaccine shopping, because I said yesterday, I have a shot booked for tomorrow through a mass clinic. Because of my postal code, but I also went on wait lists for the pharmacies in case they came in earlier, because I want to get the shot as fast as possible. So, Chris, are people at fault here, or is the system at fault?
Well, I think that regardless of what's happening right now, yesterday we were talking about this clinic in Manotick that ended up missing a couple of dozen shots, right? We have the capacity right now. I think if we're missing a few shots in the day, we have a chance to make it up, and we could do it every single weekend right now, where we've seen a drop down in the number of vaccinations that are happening in Ontario. We fell something from like 130,000 last week to only 70,000 roughly happening yesterday. I know people have their issues. I know that there's some frustration from people trying to book these, including at doctor's offices, of trying to make up for what's happened in these cancellation levels. But the truth is, we do have the time to get this done. If we have more vaccines going out on Saturday and Sunday, it'll make up for any appointments that are lost through the entire course of this frustrating process.
Michael Wood, what do you say?
I agree with you, Graham. I think maybe 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, there's a lot of talk on social media about vaccine shopping. I totally agree. I think people are signing up. They want to get the vaccine. They want life to return to normal. And with doing so, they are on the wait list for all the drugstores and all of the different portals. And from what I understand, and I haven't had to do this, but it's almost impossible to cancel your appointment. If you're on these wait lists, there should be one central phone number you can call in. You say, great, I got it. Please release my vaccine appointment to anybody else in our community that wants it.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more on our top five stories. I want to read some of your texts. I got a very simple text just a moment ago. Pick one. I think that's me. I think they're saying I shouldn't be on wait lists and have a booking as well. I have taken myself off wait lists because it was getting closer to my booked shot. I received an email from Walmart this morning asking me to confirm my appointment, so I should be good to go. Thanks, Barry. I was super lucky. I went to Walmart site last Wednesday, selected a random Walmart pharmacy in the Ottawa area, and found a dozen or so open slots. You timed it well. Lucky. Booked an appointment for later today. Out of curiosity, I went back to the site 5 minutes later, selected the same pharmacy, and got no appointments available. Again, timing. And here, finally here, before we get to break, I've been on a waiting list for four pharmacies and nothing. This is so frustrating. Ottawa needs a central system. People don't mind driving an hour or taking the time out to stand in line for 4 hours at the time of day we get the vaccine. Why is it so hard for our province? This is giving the world a bad impression of our country. Third world countries are doing better than us, D writes. There is that frustration that is this the best way to do it? This is a much larger vaccination program than the flu vaccine. Should pharmacies have been given so many shots? What about family doctors? Maybe they should have just sent it all to public health units. We're back in a moment. I'm Graham Richardson, in for Leslie Roberts on Ottawa at Work. Welcome back. I'm Graham Richardson, in for Leslie Roberts, here with Michael Wood on the phone and Chris Holsky here in the studio. We've been asking for your AstraZeneca pharmacy stories. Listen to this one. I was on a couple of waiting lists, finally got an appointment, and canceled my waiting lists. The pharmacy canceled my appointment due to no vaccine. Actually, they haven't officially told me. My friends whose appointment were before mine told me there's not enough vaccine and now I can't get through to them. My appointment is this afternoon. That's Morgan in Barrhaven. If I understand Morgan correctly, they went out and canceled all of their wait lists because they had a solid booking, because the solid booking from the particular pharmacy, they've now heard that they're canceling appointments because of lack of vaccine and Morgan can't get through to try to find out what's going on, and the bookings this afternoon.
Oh, that's brutal. You know what? I'm starting to
This is where people joke and call it the Hunger Games of vaccines.
Yes.
That's what this is about.
You know, I'm starting to think the wait lists are causing a bit of a problem here themselves. I mean, that's one thing the central booking system doesn't have. There's no wait list. You either get an appointment or you don't. And all you're doing is sending people on a bunch of a runaround to try to cancel all these wait lists that you've gone on. Just instead of doing that, just say, hey, we have this many appointments. Here's your shot. Here's your time. And if there aren't any that are left at that point, tough luck. At least you're not running around everywhere to try to clean up the mess that's left behind.
Michael Wood, do you have a shot?
Well, I don't yet. And I've added myself to wait list, and I'm waiting to hear. And I feel very bad for Morgan. We have to grab this thing by the horns and figure out how this is going to work out for all of us.
It's got to be better than this. Overall, it's got to be better. I want to end this particular topic on a positive, though. We're getting there. Latest public health vaccination first shot stats. This is as of yesterday, okay? 60% of people who are... Oh, now, look, the thing on my phone is all... It's just broken down in age groups. Ugh, anyway, 60% of people in the 60 to 69 age group have a single shot. As you get older, into the 70s, it's above 80. The 80s, 86.7, and the 90s, 89.1. Those are extraordinary numbers for any city. Like, keep in mind, you know, if your target is 75%, if your age groups, the most vulnerable age groups are in the high 80s, that's not messing around. That's very good.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but the ends may be justifying the means in this case right now. Not like there's any malice or anything happening. But at the end of the day, even when we've had stories about people who have been confused by the system, they've still ended up getting an appointment and they still ended up getting their shots. And we're getting a lot out there in Ottawa.
One final story I wanted to talk about. Metro is going to give gift cards to people as a pandemic work bonus, and the union is not happy. Michael Wood, what do you say about this? I mean, gift cards are not nothing. Gift cards are food. Gift cards can be, you know, you could spend them on beer or wine at the Metro if you wanted. What do you think of this?
Well, I think that, you know, everything at the Metro, right, was bought at cost. So the gift card is a much better option for Metro itself. However, like myself and you and Chris, when we make money and we were to make a bonus, we'd love to be able to spend that money on whatever we want to spend it on. And I'm sure there's a lot of things that aren't sold at Metro that you want to purchase. And perhaps I think I would have probably, you know, gone with the regular cash method, if you will.
Cash, Chris?
Yeah, well, still, if you're going with gift cards, I think grocery store cards are the best ones you can get, because no matter what, you need food anyway, and eventually you are going to go through them. But still, yes, cash, the better option.
It's better than nothing, but maybe just a bit better. They could have done cash. Thanks, both of you, for joining us. Chris Holsky heading into the newsroom, the CTV newsroom, for your 9:30 update. Michael Wood, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for this.
Thanks so much, Graham. Thanks, Chris.
All right. I'm Graham Richardson, in for Leslie Roberts. We're back after the news at 9:30. Stay with us. On this Tuesday, thanks so much for being here. Not a bad day out there. A little cool this morning, but and we're going to get some rain later. But hey, the sun is shining right now. We've been spending a lot of time talking about vaccines, how to get one, what it means to get one. And we thought we'd talk to someone about the nuts and bolts of what you need to know once you get a shot. So many people are getting them. What does that mean? How long does it take to kick in? Dr. Suman Chakrabarty is an infectious disease specialist at Trillium Health Partners. He joins us now on the line. Doctor, tell us about how long it will take for the vaccines to kick in and become effective. Does it vary?
It does if you look at the numbers, but actually if you look at them all together and what they're actually doing, it's all about the same. So when you're looking at, say, the Pfizer or AstraZeneca, you start to get actually immunity quite quickly. And by the time 2 weeks rolls around, your immune system has already built up something, but it might not be the max amount of potential immunity you can get. But by 1 month, that first dose is actually pretty protective, as so long as you have a relatively normal immune system. So all bets are off if, for example, you're on a transplant medication or chemotherapy. But the point is, after about a month, you're pretty significantly protected from hospitalization. It's hard to give a number on that, but what I mean by that is we're talking excess of 90%, but you might still get COVID. You might still get some symptoms of it. So it all matters the two things we care about, death and hospitalization, and those things are very well protected after about a month.
Okay, so a month in, the shot protects you. You cannot say in terms of a number if you're one shot, but your chances of hospitalization and death are very, very remote, even with one shot.
That's exactly right. And now, that also said, is that, you know, I'm talking about that at a month. I've seen multiple people in hospital who have gotten one shot of the vaccine, and they get hospitalized. Usually they tend to be older and have other comorbidities. But the one very interesting thing that I've noticed is that these people, especially once you're getting to about the two-week point, they're sick, but they're not as sick as the people who are the same conditions as them without a vaccine. So it's still having some type of effect. These vaccines are powerful, but I always tell people, rather than looking at these numbers, think about the two main things, death and hospitalization. All four of the vaccines we have presently are amazing at preventing that about a month after the shot.
And people have spent a lot of time worrying about Canada's plan with the extension of the second shot. What are we missing in delaying it that long? Anything? Or do we know?
We don't know, but one thing I do want to mention, I think that people think of vaccination, at least the COVID vaccination, the two shots, as filling a glass. So the first shot is half full, the second shot is full. But that's not actually how it works. When you have the first shot, after 1 month, you've actually gotten pretty good protection against, like I said, death and hospitalization. I think of it like a master's degree, as my colleague Dr. Barrett says, Lisa Barrett. The second shot kind of takes that master's and turns it into a PhD. So it still works, and it fortifies it and makes it more long-lasting. But the thing is, the first shot is still giving you very significant protection, and that gap that we're seeing, we've seen that with vaccinations, the memory cells can actually be stimulated months afterwards. So 4 months might be okay, but I'm always of the mind, it's a new vaccine, let's try to stick to the trial as close as possible.
Tell me about the long-term protection. Like, first of all, let's start. Okay, so you get the first shot. Nothing should be changing in your behavior right away because it takes, as you said, a couple of weeks to get some protection, and full protection one shot, it takes at least a month, the studies have shown. So no behavior change for at least for the first month or at all.
I would say that it's a very good point that you make. Yeah, I have seen, unfortunately, people, as soon as they've gotten the shot, the next day they go and have a big get-together and have gotten COVID. So we have to, of course, be careful. But, you know, once you're starting to get out to a month, right, in Canada we don't have good guidance yet of what you can do, but I think that we have to be careful about this because people are going to be gathering. People are chomping at the bit to see their family, and I don't blame them. It's been a long time. So I think that we should be offering guidance to people of what they can do with one shot or two shots, just like the CDC has done in the States.
Why is there that reluctance to do that? We've got millions of people who have a shot. Is it that they're concerned that people will change their behavior too much and it's too risky to give them new guidance now, given the number of shots that are out there?
I think so. I think that's what the perception is, that if we tell people that they can do something, they'll go crass phrase, buck wild. But I think that we have to be careful about this because my goal has always been with messaging in the pandemic is risk mitigation rather than abstinence-based messaging. Right now we're in the middle of the third wave, so I get it. I think there's the optics of giving some kind of concession might be a bit off right now, but we should have something coming up soon as this wave starts to recede because people are going to be doing this anyway, and I think the best thing that we can do is help mitigate risk. Yeah, there will be people that will hang out a bit too early with people, but if we tell people, look, wait for a month at least and then don't be having massive parties, at least you know that's going to help with the messaging, help with risk reduction, and overall help things so we don't get into a big wave of cases once we start to release restrictions.
And if people stick to that advice, it's also the truth. This is the tricky part of public health messaging. Sometimes the truth can do wider damage because people take the truth and they go too far. And so I understand why doctors and public health units want to withhold some of the truth. I'm not saying they're misleading people. They're just not releasing the truth too early because if they go out now and say, once you've had the shot after a month, you can do X, Y, and Z, they know that people are going to do it after 2 weeks and go further, and that potentially could cause more risk.
Potentially. I agree with that. But I think on the counterpoint to that is that we're a year into the pandemic, actually longer than a year, and people are really, really wanting to see their family members.
Yes.
We really want to get to some kind of semblance of normalcy. And I think that's normal. That's what we should be feeling at this point. And I think that at this point, we want to be transparent. We want to let people know, yeah, we're in a third wave. It's a serious situation. But we have something to look forward to. We need a roadmap out of here. And I tend to like to trust people. I know there's going to be people that don't follow the guidance, mm-hmm. but most will. And that's what we are seeing right now. And that's why I think that we need to give people concessions after doses of the vaccine, because the vaccine works. It's a really, really good thing. We want people to get it.
What is the latest on, I have a shot, let's say I'm fully immunized with two shots. Can I still carry COVID, or do they know?
The evidence is continuing to mount that, yeah, you potentially can, but the risk of transmission is a lot lower. there's really no vaccine. There's very few vaccines, I should say, that completely eliminate your risk of transmitting something. Most of them have what we call a mitigating effect. But the mitigating effect for this vaccine, the COVID vaccine, is really, really good. So is there a chance that, yeah, you can have a little bit of virus and you can spread it to one person? Sure. But if you look at the grand scheme of things, if you didn't have the vaccine, you could spread it to 80 people. And, you know, on the global and population scale, that's what's important to get out of the pandemic.
Last question for you. What do you think September looks like? What do you think December looks like going forward? It's always a very difficult thing to predict, but I guess with the vaccine rolling out, it's becoming more more predictable how to view this. What is your view of what it looks like?
I think my view is actually quite a bright one. I think that the vaccine is clearly very effective. Of course, there's a bit of a wild card with the variants, but that said, I think it's something we could manage. What I expect COVID to be is a circulating respiratory virus that we may have some increase in cases come September, come the winter time. But the main thing is it's not something we're going to have to stop the community for. We won't have to do community restrictions. It's something that, yeah, we'll see more cases in the wintertime. We're going to have to deal with it in the hospital system, but we're not going to have to close down the rest of society. One big thing to remember, as vaccines continue to go out, the more cases we see, the less hospitalizations there are. And remember, hospitalizations, especially rapid expansion of them, is what got us in the situation in the first place. So if we eliminate that, we're not going to have as much of an impact to what we do in our everyday lives.
Dr. Suman Chakrabarty with the Trillium Health Partners, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Absolutely.
Really good information. Thank you. There you have it. So sort of an ABC on vaccination. I got a text just now. I want to read this out. Graham, how about, for once, telling people they can still carry and pass the virus after being vaccinated? You guys fail at every turn to remind people they are still able to carry and pass the virus even after a vaccination. Well, I just asked that question. And the doctor responded, who knows this, that if you're vaccinated, yes, you can carry a small amount of the vaccine, but to suggest that it's the same or even close to the same as non-vaccinated person is factually incorrect. So when you're fully vaccinated, let's say with two shots, there is the possibility that you can still carry and pass on COVID. But as the doctor just said on the air, you can't pass it to 8 people or 80 people. You might pass it to 1, but that may even be compromised by the strength of the vaccine. So we didn't blow it. We just reported it, and we didn't fail at every turn. Anyway, we're back in a moment. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts on Ottawa at Work. Stay with us.
This is News Talk 580 CFRA. This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Be a part of the conversation. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Welcome back. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts today. Just going through some of your texts right now. Really interesting about this question we just had. We're still hearing lots about pharmacies and injections and trying to get the vaccination. I'll get to that in just a moment. But just the topic we just spoke about, you know, what you can and can't do after you're vaccinated. This is from Neil in Alta Vista. I heard two doctors being questioned about this on another station. They sounded uncomfortable, but one did finally say that really people after one dose could probably get together much more safely with others vaccinated, but it would be not be fair to those who were still not vaccinated. So for equality, no one should change their behavior. So possibly political, ethical considerations, similar to a vaccine passport, not a rationale to my liking. Thanks for that, Neil. This is a very good point, right? This is what I was trying to get at with the doctor. Is this a limited truth-telling for other reasons? Like he just said, after a month with one shot, you are very well protected. If everyone in your circle has that one shot, what is your risk factor? Are they not telling us that you can gather at a distance indoors, for instance, or outdoors with masks off, for instance, if everybody's had one shot. Are they not telling us that because not enough people have had one shot and they think that people are going to go overboard after 13 months of this yo-yo kind of existence of what you can and can't do, and people are so pent up that the risk will go up for those not vaccinated? So it'll be very interesting to see what the guidance will be from Canada, from the Public Health Agency, from the provinces, because the CDC has already said what Americans can do because their vaccination rate is much, much higher. So what do you think about that? Should they be straight with us and tell us, knowing that some people will break the rules and some people will jump the gun and take too much risk and go ahead and do things they shouldn't do? Or should they just be straight with us and say, here's what you can do A, B, C, and D after one shot. Here's what you can do after two shots. But don't do a lot of these things with anyone who hasn't had a shot. I wonder if they'll be that clear. I wonder if that'll happen. We've spent a lot of time talking about essential workers in factories and retail. They're among the highest risk of catching COVID-19. So should we, ethically as consumers, make different decisions based on that? Zainab Arsenal is a associate professor of marketing at Concordia. He joins us on the line now. What about that? Should we change our behavior based on the risk of workers who are serving us remotely?
Hi, Leslie. Thanks for having me. Yes, we definitely have to consider what our impact is for every decision. But I think the issue is that there's people who do not care, right? So I'm going to be the party pooper here, and there's people who are not going to care. But a majority of the people who do care, but I think we are putting them in a situation that is quite impossible for them to make the right decision. And reflecting on what you just said about the vaccines, too, is most citizens do not have enough information to figure out what's the right thing to do. We need to give clear and consistent information about what risk is. And one of the things that I think most, you know, people do not understand, that when you look around the things you own, the things you buy, there's people working to bring them to your life, right? But yeah. when we make these purchase decisions, we don't see that information, right? We see a price, we see a color, we don't understand, for example, if somebody's paid a living wage to produce them, are they living in and working in healthy conditions? We're not giving that information. But when we do put the responsibility of them to do the right thing, and I think we're sort of expecting very little from firms to actually produce ethical goods and too much from individual people to make decisions to buy ethical goods when they actually might not know what is ethical.
And our economy is set up in a way that we as consumers are shielded from how that product gets to our doorstep or on the shelf at the grocery store. That's the way the system's designed. And so it would take an extra amount of work by the consumer. Hey, did that come from an ethical place? Did that come from an Amazon warehouse, particularly with a big COVID outbreak? I don't know how practical it would be to adjust our behavior. Could we even do it?
Absolutely. I think we're shielded. Think about even meat. When we buy meat, it's in a styrofoam thing. We don't even consider that as an animal, right? And it's the same thing. We buy jeans and we don't understand that it's made in a factory that might be polluting the environment or mistreating the workers. We're shielded, but that's also a survival mechanism for everyday people, right? Because it's actually exhausting. So think about, if you look around the things you own, and if you start to calculate how much harm you're doing, you might consider that maybe I'll just grow my own tomatoes. And
that's the simplest way. Grow your own tomatoes if you can do it. Zainab, I'm sorry, we're out of time. I appreciate you joining us today. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
All right.
Have a nice day.
You too. Zainab Arsenal is a associate professor of marketing at Concordia University. Before we get to news, I have a text here that's very, very simple. And I think I know the answer, but I haven't heard it from a doctor, so I'm not going to answer it. Graham, if grandparents are fully vaccinated, can the grandchildren visit? Well, if the grandparents are fully vaccinated with two shots, they've been protected. The reason we're staying apart from each other is to tamp down infections and keep our circles small. Theoretically, if the grandparents were out and about, theoretically, they could still carry the virus and pass it to the grandchildren who haven't been vaccinated. But as we heard from the doctor earlier, that's very, very remote. The grandparents are much more protected. So I don't know the answer to that, but that's what public health is going to have to wrestle with. Because in my family, I've got grandparents in Alberta, in-laws who are fully vaccinated. They're coming back to Ontario. Are they allowed to visit us in the house? We've actually said, no, I don't think so, not yet. But I don't know if I'm right because they're fully vaccinated and they're going to come visit a month after the second shot. So we're getting to the point here where someone's going to have to give Canadians guidance on the best thing to do. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts. Breaking for news now in the CTV newsroom. Stay with us. It's on this Tuesday. We're getting a lot of reaction to this. The question of the day, post-vaccination, what are the rules? Canada hasn't really said yet. The Centers for Disease Control has said certain things. Canada is holding back, I think, any advice until more people are vaccinated. I'd mentioned a text earlier from someone asking about if the grandparents are vaccinated, can the grandkids come and visit? I mean, the clear answer is until everybody's got a shot, until everybody's had two shots, the answer is no. But given the schedule and the timetable, how realistic is that to wait for every single person to get double shots? They're going to have to put out some guidance is my point. I'm not suggesting to that person who texted that it's okay to go and do that with the grandkids. All I'm saying is I don't know the answer, and there hasn't been advice from public health yet on what the proper answer is. But I do know that a double shot for the grandparents fully vaccinated, as we've heard over and over again, the protection is quite extraordinary from these new vaccines. It is quite something to see. I don't know if you've gone to the dentist lately, but I just went, and my dentist joked that it's like you're walking into the set of like a a Dexter set. That's what she said. She said it's like being on the set of Dexter. And if you've ever seen Dexter, you know what I mean. Lots of plastic, lots of protective equipment. It's a changed environment. Dr. David Stevenson, a dentist in Carleton Place, he heads up the Ontario Dental Association's Pandemic Recovery Working Group. He joins us now. What kind of an outlay in terms of investment have your members had to make? To the casual patient, it sure looks significant.
Good morning, Graham. Thanks for having me. I think we have to consider it important to acknowledge at the beginning that there isn't a business around that hasn't been affected or impacted by COVID-19. But one of the biggest differences that relates to dental offices is the fact that our business is a mini hospital. And so the core purpose is for us to be able to provide treatment, keep patients out of the regular hospitals, and also to be able to provide that treatment safely. So there has been significant challenges that COVID-19 has brought across. It's not that we haven't seen them before. We've been through this with HIV in the early 80s and SARS in 2000s, but there's been a significant capital outlay, so in other words, modifications to the structure of our buildings and our operatories and even our waiting rooms. Mm-hmm. But there's also been ongoing costs of PPE and the supplies. I think people are used to seeing their dentist in wearing a lot of PPE, a lot of plastic, as you mentioned earlier. But the degree and the quality and the caliber of the PPE that we're wearing now is significantly different.
And the other element here is that you are not funded by taxpayers' dollars. You're funded by insurance, by out-of-pocket for some people. So yes, it's healthcare, but it's different.
It's health. The actual care is healthcare, period. But the business model is different. And you're correct. And this is why I related to earlier that it is always a balance, that dentists are healthcare providers and hygienists are healthcare providers. Our assistants are all part of that team, but we're also small business owners. And you're right that the degree to which dentists or dental offices have sort of gone it alone outside of the public system is significant.
What are you asking for then? Are you asking for anything from government because of this outlay of capital?
One of the primary asks that we had from the very beginning was to get access to good quality, authentic PPE. Everybody needs that. At the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of dental offices gave their PPE to the hospitals to fight for that earlier crisis cause. So we're asking to get access to that, and that has improved dramatically. Even from the manufacturing side, because we do have to go it on our own and get it from our manufacturers. Earlier in the pandemic, there was such a great supply and demand difference, but now that is leveling off. It's still costlier to procure what we need to procure, but we are getting access to that. But one of the fundamental things, and this is not new to the pandemic, we do have substantial population that is on government-funded dental care programs, and the government, we know they're going to have to step up with some of the funding to that at some point soon.
Are your patients coming back? Because I would imagine, just like everything else, people have put off that cleaning until they feel safer. Are you finding them that they're coming back?
Yes, they are, Graham. I think early in the pandemic, there was a lot of uncertainty. But that has now, so much of that uncertainty has gone. There's still some uncertainty and some unreliability as to what the stage of the pandemic is. So is there some hesitancy? Yes, but very little in our experience. I think patients are very much anxious to come back in treatment. We've demonstrated that we've done it safely. I think they trust their dentist and their dental office to be able to provide that care safely, and that's important. Having said that, we are, just like other businesses, we do have some capacity limitations. We can't see as many patients throughout the day as that we are accustomed to. We can't have as much staff in our office. And so we have to spread that out. And so that is impacting. Some patients may be a little bit frustrated if they can't get the care that they actually were hoping for, or perhaps it's a little bit delayed. But we are getting to everybody as quickly as we can. And in our experience, Graham, the patients are very much appreciative of it.
We appreciate your time. Thanks for being here, Dr. Stevenson. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. That's Dr. David Stevenson with the Dentists Across Ontario, talking about what's required to get them back up on their feet. They've had significant costs associated with the pandemic. You got to also remember, and I don't often think of it this way, but the aerosol at a dental procedure, and what I mean by that is when they're drilling, when they're in your mouth, when they're doing those things, the amount of debris that is floating in the air is very, very infectious, obviously, right? They are right in the middle of all of it. I'm Graham Richardson, in for Leslie Roberts. When we come back, I want to continue to go through some of your texts on the sick leave issue, on the pharmacies issue, and on the question of the day, which seems to be, it was a great text. If the grandparents are fully vaccinated, what can they do? What can't they do? There have been no official answers from Ottawa Public Health or from the country. They're holding off on that. And should they be holding off on that? Should they be telling people now, here's what you can do once you're vaccinated? We've got a low case count in Ottawa today, 150 confirmed cases. That's from the province. We'll wait to hear from Ottawa Public Health. A caution, low case count, 150. It used to be 50 was a low case count. It used to be 50 used to be high. Now 150 is low. We'll see what the public health count is. And I caution that Tuesdays, generally speaking, are quite low because they kick in on the weekend and people delay their tests on the weekend tend not to go and put up with symptoms and then go later. So we tend to see heavier case counts later in the week and a dip around Tuesday, but it's better than going higher. We're back in just a moment on Ottawa at Work. Welcome back to Ottawa at Work. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts. I wanted to give you a snapshot of the case counts in the seven-day average. Ontario, 3,888 cases a day. The seven-day average, that's down from the previous wave three high. We're up to 29.6 deaths a day province-wide. So on today's numbers, 3,265 province-wide, 29 deaths. 29 deaths. You know, like, the first two waves, the deaths were higher. Obviously, as soon as it hit a long-term care home, you're going to get more deaths. And they've managed to eliminate that. And so that's a good thing, but it is still a reminder of how quickly this thing is moving. Locally in Ottawa, the province reporting 150. There has been some discrepancy throughout the pandemic between Ottawa Public Health numbers and the provincial numbers. Will both on both ends. Sometimes it's higher locally, sometimes it's lower locally. So we'll wait to see at noon when they update roughly what it is. Some of the text today. Again, about vaccines and trying to get them and at pharmacies, but also a significant amount of discussion about what you can do once you're vaccinated. Had a very simple question from someone. If grandparents are fully vaccinated, can grandchildren visit? And I mean, the short answer is no. And another listener texted this in. I thought you can't be together without health measures like masking, distancing, etc. until both parties are vaccinated. That's right. That's right. Since you can still carry, contract, and spread the virus if you're vaccinated, although at a much, much reduced rate. The doctor we had on again reminded us is that once you're vaccinated, even with the single shot, you're very highly protected. And yes, you can carry it, but the chances of you spreading it like you spread it unvaccinated are almost nil. It's very, very likely that you will not spread it, but there is a chance. So that's good caution. So I think people are grappling with the various levels of vaccination that are coming between the ages. For me, in my family, everybody 50 and over in our family, in our immediate family, either has a shot or has a booking. And that's not the case for our teenagers. That's not the case for our 20-somethings. So what does that mean for July if there's a family gathering? Can you have the family gathering? Is public health going to tell us because of the different levels of vaccination and timelines that all family gatherings should not start again outside or inside until August 1? Are they working through those scenarios right now behind the scenes? Why haven't they told us this yet? My guess is that yes, they are. But I think the notion, we've all learned that a flip of the switch doesn't exactly happen automatically. But I also remember, and I know we're in the third wave with more infectious variants, but I am reminded of last summer and last spring when cases started to come down. I'll never forget in June. Mid-June, early June, I believe the date was the 8th or 9th, I tweeted out zero new cases in Ottawa. Like, we're probably going to get there again, but that won't mean zero new cases. Zero new cases won't mean zero cases overall in hospital. Another topic that we've been talking a lot about that people have been texting about. Renfrew County vaccination clinics are seeing people from Stittsville and Ottawa. Please remind listeners to stay in their health unit areas or under a stay-at-home order. It's a good point. And the people who went outside, and I know they're out there, lots of them did. They heard about a walk up at Perth, so then they lined up and they were from Ottawa. We'll say that, yeah, but that's a medical appointment to get a vaccine, so it's an essential trip. Getting a vaccine is more essential than any essential trip. This person would argue, yeah, but more movement around into different health units doesn't help. And potentially you can spread, especially if you're not vaccinated. Fair point. So they're seeing people from Stittsville and Ottawa. This is David from Ottawa. I got my first Pfizer shot a month ago. I have no delusions that even a second dose, I will be protected from this year's mutations. Thank heavens pandemics virtually end, eventually end naturally. Well, David, that's true, but the science and the studies are telling us that the first and the second Pfizer shots protect you almost 100% from hospitalization and death. That is just, those are the facts. Millions of doses have now been dispensed. And his point is the virus is going to continue to mutate and there's nothing we can do about that. And we should just expect, like the Spanish flu, there were no vaccines and it wreaked havoc around the world for several years, not just 2 years. And then it became manageable. And that's where we're going to get. I think it's a combination of things. I think given the vaccine's efficacy and the ability to roll them out around the world, we're going to have a certain amount of immunity from herd, and we're going to have a certain amount of immunity from vaccinations. I don't think that vaccinations can be that easily dismissed. One other on vaccinations, Montreal texting. I had an appointment for today that I booked a week ago. I received a follow-up reminder yesterday confirming my appointment time for today, which I accepted. Literally 1 hour after, I get another message saying my appointment has now been rescheduled for 1 week later. I'd already gone and canceled my name on other wait lists. This is frustrating. Ugh. Ugh. I can't, this is where, you know, I'm assuming that is a pharmacy. I know locally, the health unit, and if you have a vaccine booking through Ottawa Public Health and one of their mass vaccination clinics, that booking is linked to a vaccine. So they don't make a booking without a vaccine. They don't make a booking without, I mean, obviously they're anticipating a delivery, but the delivery has generally been fairly solid. We are going to head to the CTV newsroom for your 11 o'clock news. And when we come back, we're going to speak with Jason Tetreault. He's a microbiology expert and author of The Germ Code. He's known as the Germ Guy. And he famously or infamously several weeks ago, before the third wave hit hard, he thinks that this pandemic is over in September, in late summer. So I'm going to ask him if he still believes that, or has the pandemic changed his thinking. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts. Let's head to the CTV newsroom and your news headlines at 11 o'clock.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Agree or disagree, we want to hear from you. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Welcome back. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts today. Leslie's back tomorrow. We've been sort of looking forward as much as we can. Yes, we're in the third wave and the numbers are challenging, but this will end in some way. And a lot of people are watching the Americans who are ahead of us on vaccinations. Some debate as to how far ahead of us they are. Some suggest it's months and months. I'm not so sure. Particularly with vaccine hesitancy in the United States higher than it is here. Jason Tetreault is a microbiology expert and author of The Germ Code. He joins us now, The Germ Guy. Jason, how are you?
Hey, pretty good.
Good to talk to you. Last time we spoke, you had suggested the pandemic will come to an end in September, end of summer. Do you still believe that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're in the third act, and if you've ever watched Star Wars, Die Hard, or any of these action movies, the villain always makes a comeback, right?
Right.
And the reason the comeback has happened is very, very, very simple. Because of the variants, we have to reduce our contacts by 10 to 15%. Instead, we've gone closer together 10 to 15%, thinking that we can rely on the vaccine. That 30% difference is what you're seeing in the numbers. It's just that simple.
So the messaging about the arrival of the vaccines and the dominance in the news coverage about the arrival of the vaccine, of course, drove human behavior. That's part of the problem leading to third wave.
Exactly. And the problem that we always run into is, and again, action movie, you get the new weapon, you get the new thing that's going to save us all. But what you tend to forget is that in order for us to get to the big bad guy and eliminate the big bad guy, we have a lot of problems that we have to go through. And while we normally sit down in a movie theater and enjoy that, when it happens in real life, we are having a really difficult time with this. And unfortunately, what's happened is that those who are basically at the top in the political realm have decided that they're going to rely on that weapon as opposed to making sure that people continue to follow everything we've done in the first two acts to reduce the amount of spread and unfortunate pain.
Because it's no fun to come out and say, even though some have, it's no fun to come out and say in January and February, we've got five more months of this. I didn't hear a lot of that. I heard some of that, and it's not all on them. It's on people, too. It's on people's behavior, too.
Oh, yeah.
So if they had done that and convinced people to temper their behavior, even as that early spring weather swept across Quebec and Ontario, we would for sure be in a better place if people listened. That's the other thing, if people listened.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right, is... We always, from an infection perspective, you know that it's over 28 days, in this case, two times the incubation period, when you've had zero cases, okay? We've never reached that. We got really, really, really close last year around this time, and yeah. I'm sure that we're going to get really, really, really close again, but this time it's not going to be because we locked everything down, but because of the vaccination. The fact is that one way or the other, we're going to get there. It's just... how much pain are we willing to take in that process? And I think a lot of the discussions now have gone from preventing a virus, whether it survives on surfaces or airborne, to more social concerns, such as essential workers and people should be getting sick days, you know, these types of things. So it's really good that we're changing the conversation to a social one instead of a microbiological one, but at the same time, we can't forget the virus doesn't care.
Right. What do you think, about outdoor masking, practically speaking, in the Canadian context, how long, like we had Theresa Tam hinting that some restrictions could lift if we hit 75% vaccination. How realistic is that?
Oh, no, that's fine. I mean, probably around 65 to 66% vaccination may even be enough to be able to start seeing that plummeting of cases. And we're definitely going to start seeing the plummeting of the hospitalizations and deaths. Where the issue really comes into play has very little to do with, you know, the virus and everything. It has to do with what's called vapor pressure. In the wintertime, you know, when you're standing on the street, say at the bus stop or just waiting to cross the street, you can really smell the exhaust of cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that means that the vapor pressure is so high that essentially droplets are right there in the air and you can sort of bring those in. So if you happen to have a crowd outside and you have this high vapor pressure, yeah, it's going to be just as bad as being indoors. Now, when it's warmer out, you don't smell the exhaust, do you? Because
right.
It's dissipating. The vapor pressure has lightened up. And so as a result of that, what's going to happen is that these droplets are going to get diluted in the air, and therefore the whole idea of needing masks is not going to be all that necessary. That's also one of the reasons why seasonality exists with things like the common cold and the flu.
Why haven't they done directives yet in Canada on what you can and can't do? We had one question about... if both parents or both grandparents are vaccinated, can they see their grandchildren?
Right now, I think the big problem is that we have such a diverse nature of rules, regulations, guidelines across the country that it's very difficult. And, you know, we've all heard about Section 22, right? You know, what they're using down in Peel to shut things down.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing about the Health Protection and Prevention Act, or HPPA, is that it prevents the federal government from telling provinces what to do. So as much as Dr. Tam and some of the others down there might want to actually say, okay, well, the science says this, we recommend this, they're not really allowed. Because that's up to provincial governments to do. So unfortunately, what we really need is to have some kind of mandate where we do have a pandemic or some kind of emergency situation whereby one voice speaks for all. doubt it's ever going to happen, but that's what we need.
And what do you think, if you're holding to September, it's over, what do you think what do you think the summer will look like, generally speaking, for Canadians? Are we traveling inside the country? Maybe not like normal?
Oh, I mean, we should be definitely traveling within the country. What's going to probably also happen is a lot of first developed or developed nations are going to be opening up their borders for travel passports. Basically, if you're vaccinated or you can show that you've been negative over three tests, you're going to be able to come in. So we're going to have a lot of that. That's going to continue probably until about the end of the year, and then we'll start probably reducing those restrictions as well. I don't imagine that we're going to have a completely free summer, but at the end of the day, you know, Blues Fest 22 really is only, what, 14 months away? So,
yeah, that's true. 2 years in a row without Blues Fest, it's going to be quite the time.
I know. It's so hard, though, and I totally understand that. It's really frustrating. But at the same time, when you have that many people coming together and you do have a virus that is circulating, even if it's at a lower level than it is, say, during the winter time, it can still be a threat. And we already are seeing now what happens when it hits the lower age groups. It's not that people are more protected. It's just simply that there are a number of vulnerable people. It's just you have to get a high enough level of the virus in the population before they start to pop up.
All right, Jason, we really appreciate this.
It was a pleasure. Take care.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Graham Richardson, in for Leslie Roberts. We're going to take a quick break and talk more about your questions on pharmacies and on AstraZeneca, and also on vaccination rates and what is permitted and what is not. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Graham Richardson, sitting in for Leslie Roberts on this Tuesday. Hope you're having a good day. We're hoping to connect with CTV's Queen's Park Bureau Chief Colin DeMello, who is following the Ford government. There are several developments there today on paid sick leave and what the province plans. There's also rumors about some kind of a PCR test being required for interprovincial travel. And Bob Fife mentioned that off the top of the broadcast here about them doing something to test people who are entering Ontario by air. Now, I'm not exactly Mr. Airport Regulations guy, but the feds do control the airport, so I'm not quite sure what the province has planned, but apparently Ontario is looking at something on that. Joining us now on the line is Colin DeMello from the Queen's Park Bureau of CTV. Hey, Colin, how are you?
Hey, good afternoon. Good morning.
Almost afternoon. It's probably afternoon for you. You've been up early. You're always up early. It's the political beat.
When you also have two kids who climb into your bed at night and then decide to kick you in the head, yes. We're always up early.
Tell me about paid sick leave. If I understand it correctly, this is an ask and an offer to the feds that the feds have already said no to BC over because it's too complicated. Is this doomed to fail, or do we know yet?
Well, it seems like the federal government is kind of rejecting this proposal, but we're waiting to hear officially what the federal government does. I mean, the Canada Sickness Recovery Benefit currently gives employees about $500 per week if they've missed about 50% of the work week. But, you know, a lot of employees have not been using it simply because, you know, you would have to forfeit the pay first and then recoup that money back. A lot of them choose to just go into work sick instead and then create a minor outbreak as a result. So what the Ford government is proposing is to double the benefit that employees get from $500 per week to $1,000 per week. And the province is saying that Ontario would pay that second $500. So, you know, the federal government wouldn't have to increase the program, but the province would certainly double the benefit paid to employees. And that's what they're qualifying as paid sick leave.
So that to me sounds like, so they're trying to make the argument that this is quick and simple, but as we found out, it never is, especially when two levels of government are involved. I guess the question is too, is it too late? Like, is this kind of a program too late to actually have an impact on COVID-19, even though the numbers are still high?
Well, I think you kind of have to look at the impact of the program since its inception, right? It's been around since late 2020, yet we still see workplace outbreaks, and we still see employees going into work, despite having an illness. And we saw yesterday the daughter of an essential frontline employee who worked in the warehouse, a 13-year-old girl, she died. You could consider her, you know, collateral damage in this whole pandemic, because it was her father who is the essential employee and we believe contracted COVID-19. So even the Ford government says this program has gaps, it hasn't worked, and it hasn't really been utilized as much by employees. So doubling down on this same program, I'm not sure whether there's any data to support that, the uptake would be greater because employees would get more money out of the benefit.
And now just on the provincial side, we've gone from arguing as a government, the Ford government has gone from arguing it would be a waste to add provincial paid sick leave because the federal program isn't being used enough, to the disastrous rollout of the new measures on the Friday with the police powers and the closed playgrounds, and then finally saying, well, the feds didn't fill the gaps, so we're going to fill the gaps. And now we're at a situation, here's the plan, and if it's dead on arrival, then clearly the Ford government's just going to point the finger at Ottawa and say they didn't want to do it, it's not our fault. Hopefully we'll have something more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it's kind of boiling down to this, provincial-federal blame game, as we've kind of been seeing more and more during the pandemic, right? I mean, the Ford government has looked to kind of pivot away from its own missteps by pointing the finger at the federal government on airport security, on, border control, and now, I mean, vaccines are a perennial argument, but then also now on this paid sick leave program. The argument is we want the federal government to enhance and double the supports. But there have been a lot of people who have been calling for this to be in legislation, for people to have to not worry about whether they can put food on the table if they miss a shift, to just have to call in, they miss a day, they get a set number of defined emergency days that are paid, and that's the end of the story. The Ford government has said that they don't want businesses to bear the burden of this enhanced support. There are also calls, though, well, why don't you just turn around and recompensate the businesses themselves? Let the employees take the day off. They don't have to worry about missing pay. They don't have to worry about calling in sick or filing paperwork or doing any of those jumping through hoops. But just compensate the businesses themselves. So we don't know where the government is going with this. We don't know where they're ultimately going to land. But if it's rejected by the federal government, that's one more avenue, one more roadblock for the Ford government that they have to now navigate.
Right. And we've been seeing less of Doug Ford in the last 2 weeks than we have in the previous year. Any sense on what's going on there and why?
Well, I mean, there was a general feeling within the premier's office anyway during 2020 that the premier was overexposed. Remember, every good or bad thing that was happening in Ontario, the premier spoke about every single day during a news conference. I mean, he was the face of the government, is the face of the government in every facet of it. And so when you see so many failures in a short period of time, it's the premier who wears that. And from the perspective of the premier's office, I mean, they're looking to kind of protect and insulate him from a lot of the scandal that could be happening during the third wave. And so, the best bet is to just kind of pull him back from view, put the other ministers up front, let them wear some of the scandal, and then perhaps you bring the premier out once per week or so. We don't know if that's their strategy, but they've been trying for a long time to pull the premier back, to make him a little bit less exposed to the public and on every issue. But I'll tell you this, Graham, it's been the premier himself who has defiantly wanted to go out there, despite the best advice of his staff, to go out there and address the public every day. He felt it was important. And so he always won that argument. But just on this note, we are still in a state of emergency. And under the law, during a state of emergency, the premier of the government has to address the public regularly to give them regular updates about the state of emergency. It doesn't define in law what regular updates means, but it does define the law that the premier has to do it himself or delegate that responsibility to somebody else, and we haven't seen that happen either so far.
All right, we'll see what happens next and see if there's an announcement on something on the borders today. And we're getting lots of texts from listeners, of course, saying, you know, no questions for Justin Trudeau, all attacks on Ford, which is not fair. You know, Justin Trudeau wears a significant amount of the problems for Canada. And on this show today, I talked with Bob Fyfe about how they botched the vaccine purchase timing. This all, you know, Colin, this is like, people think it's a complicated thing. The federal government, the bottom line is the federal government was caught off guard when these vaccines were approved a couple of months earlier than scheduled. They were planning on April 1. And if you look at the vaccine rollout, that's what it bears. The bulk of the vaccines start to arrive April 1. So they did all their deals assuming April 1. That was a mistake that we paid for January, February, and now we're seeing the vaccines roll. So he deserves a significant amount of criticism about it, and Mr. Ford does as well because he's running the show in Ontario, and he has the big job there.
Right, and I think it depends on which reporter you're talking to. I mean, I cover provincial politics, which is why my focus is provincial politics. It's not about, you know, laying blame or it's about holding the person who you're responsible for, holding them to account. And you know, the words that governments say matters. I mean, last Thursday, the premier was talking about how, you know, he was reflecting on his own isolation and he came to the realization that, you know, he has a privilege that frontline employees do not. So it's interesting to see what the government is going to do now that the premier came to that realization. It's not about, you know, Ford versus Trudeau, unless, you know, the premier makes it an issue of him versus Trudeau. And I think people need to just kind of realize that, you know, a lot of times reporters, they have a particular politician who they cover or a particular government, and that's their primary focus.
Colin DeMello from Queen's Park, appreciate this.
My pleasure as always.
All right, thanks. We're going to break for the CTV News at 11:30, just past 11:30. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts.